Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Faisal Bevji, who's agreed to give the Maevsky lecture this evening. Faisal is the university research... Reader in South Asian history. And he's a fellow of St. Anthony's College, and he's held positions in New York and various other places in America, Chicago, and is the author of two books, Landscapes of the Jihad, Militancy, Morality, Modernity in 2005, and The Terrorists in Search of Humanity, Militant Islam and Global Politics, 2009.
There's one, two more.
Two actually, more.
Yes.
Ah, yes, indeed.
The Gandhi.
The Gandhi, yes, yes. And about two, 3 years ago, I think, there was an edition of Modern Intellectual History on edited by Faisal on Gandhi and Gandhi's impact on the modern world. And I was so taken up with this that I thought, oh, we must get Faisal for a Maevsky lecture. And then that book that edition of the journal was turned into a book, which we've edited, and which is published by CUP, if I remember.
Yes.
Yes. So a very impressive series of publications, and I'm very pleased and very, very honoured that he's going to agree to give this lecture this evening. And it brings to the Maevsky lecture, I think, a dimension that we haven't had in the past, which I welcome very much, is sort of politics and religion dimension, which I think is most welcome. So, without further ado, I hand it over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Karen Flood. I'm really very honoured to be asked to give the Maevsky lecture. I have been interested for many years now in the thought of Mahatma Gandhi, and increasingly through Gandhi in the Bhagavad Gita, as a text that I am only qualified to, despite my years of Sanskrit, which I've sadly forgotten, which I'm only qualified to look at as a modern text. My colleague Shruti Kapila at Cambridge and myself have, as you mentioned, edited this volume on Gandhi, but also on the Gita in modern times. And so what I want to do today is speak about Gandhi and the Gita, but with a very particular emphasis on family and paternity, and you will see why any discussion of the Gita, of course, brings up the question of family, brothers, friends, etc. So this lecture then is about the possibility of politics without paternity. As father of the nation, Gandhi plays an existential as much as political role for Indians. Is this why he must be claimed or rejected with such passion by his sons, who are unable to remain indifferent to the Mahatma more than six decades after his death? What, in fact, does it mean for a nation to have a father, however symbolic this status may be? It is curious that republics rather than monarchies tend to possess such fathers, and in the case of the United States, more than one of them. Perhaps they presume a paternal death, making possible the state's inheritance by a community of sons. And this is indeed the argument of the political philosopher Carol Pateman, who argues that the monarchical dispensation, which presumes the relationship of fathers and sons, is displaced in republics by a fraternal dispensation in which the father has to be killed, and it is politics between the sons, between the brothers, that that becomes important. So even if he is a virtuous replacement of the monarch who had to be unseated for a republic to be founded, the national patriarch is in this way an ambiguous figure. Dynastic states, of course, require no founding father because they repudiate the idea of a paternal death, and therefore the polity's inheritance by a democracy of sons. So the formula, the king is dead, long live the king, both recognizes and denies the patriarch's death. But the father of a democracy must die to become one, whether his demise is biological, political, or indeed both, since it seems as if republics, as much as monarchies, cannot do without the domestic language of family. I shall be concerned here not only with the manner in which Gandhi became India's father, but also with how he thought about the relationship between politics and paternity. The burden of my argument will be that in deploying the apparently inescapable language of familial relations in his politics, the Mahatma redefined them in such a way as to make it very difficult for Indians either to claim him as a father or constitute themselves as his sons in any conventional fashion. You will note immediately, of course, that this is a conversation about fathers and sons, not mothers and daughters, though a mother and a daughter will appear later in this lecture. Instead, their republic has always had to struggle with this patriarch, who, like the dynastic sovereign, refuses to die. Now, what is interesting about fatherhood as a role is that it is confirmed by the son's obedience as much as his resistance. For attempts to reject the father generally end up either with the son replacing him in one kind of triumph for the latter, you just have one father for another, or else being consigned to eternal immaturity in a paternal victory of another sort. This predicament faces all the sons of Gandhi in his role as father of the nation. The name of the father, in other words, does violence to the son by claiming him even when this name is rejected. But is it possible that violence enacted in the name of the father might take its strength from the failure of patriarchy? That it may be the very lack of authority in such forms of fatherhood, from paterfamilias to president, that inspire their sons with the urge both to avenge and destroy it? That this, at any rate, is a suggestive line of argument that in Avital Ronell's recent study of authority and politics in our time. There are two moments in Ronell's argument. The first is an effort to break down the autonomy of politics by noting its almost absolute reliance upon apparently non-political metaphors and similes having to do with domestic life in particular. And we know that this is true, even today in this country, when matters of finance are discussed, for instance, it is commonplace to compare the national budget to a domestic budget. We need to have savings, we need to spend within our means. These metaphors are, in fact, completely absurd for a national economy. A national economy is not a domestic economy. And yet it makes perfect sense to us, and has made perfect sense for decades and decades, if not centuries, that this link between the domestic familial realm and the political realm seems to be inescapable and inevitable. There's a remarkable instance of this in Gandhi's manifesto of 1909, entitled Hind Swaraj, or Indian Self-Rule. Written as a dialogue between a newspaper editor and a reader, one of the many striking passages in the Future Mahatma's booklet has the reader comparing British imperialism to a thief breaking into one's house, which justifies Indians in repelling him by force. To this, the editor responds by asking what the putative owner would do if he discovered the thief to be his father. Would he pretend to continue sleeping and let the thief proceed out of shame and sorrow for his father? The passage deserves quoting for the complex set of relations it describes. Of course, it's in a way typical of Gandhi to entirely divert the logic of his interlocutor in this way by inserting the father. And here is the quotation. If it is my father who has come to steal, I shall use one kind of means. If it is an acquaintance, I shall use another. And in the case of a perfect stranger, I shall use a third. If it is a white man, you will perhaps say, you will use means different from those you will adopt with an Indian thief. If it is a weakling, the means will be different from those to be adopted for dealing with an equal in physical strength. And if the thief is armed from tip to toe, I shall simply remain quiet. Thus, we have a variety of means between the father and the armed man. Again, I fancy that I should pretend to be sleeping, whether the thief was my father or that strong-armed man. The reason for this is that my father would also be armed, and I should succumb to the strength possessed by either and allow my things to be stolen. The strength of my father would make me weep with pity. The strength of the armed man would rouse in me anger, and we would become enemies. So an interesting quotation in which the insertion of the father completely destroys the metaphorical logic of Gandhi's interlocutor. What if a thief were, India is the house, the thief are the British. If a thief enters your house, would you not resist the thief by violence, is his argument. And by simply tweaking this logic a bit, by inserting, as it were, the father, but other characters as well, right? If it's a strong person or a weak person, if the thief is an Indian as opposed to a white man, etc., your response will differ. Gandhi seems to render the entire logic of the metaphor absurd. No doubt referring to the paternal role the British adopted for themselves in India, Gandhi is on the one hand drawing attention to the domestic vernacular that makes political argument possible, if only by assuming that it is merely metaphorical, and on the other insisting upon taking such reasoning seriously and showing how it disintegrates in the process. For he suggests that the colonial state is oppressive precisely because it is a father, and vice versa, of course, being in either case intimately connected to its Indian subjects. Indeed, he argues in the text that Indians kept the British in India out of desire rather than because they were forced to do so. Indians desired British goods and indeed the culture of ever-increasing consumption that imperial capitalism made possible economically as well as politically by inhibiting the productive capacities of colonial subjects in the same movement as they were denied responsibility for their own futures. On the one hand, then, the colonial state was a false father because its authority was derived from the son's desire, as if in a perverse version of social contract theory, you know, where you decide, the sons, as it were, decide to get together and to as if elect a father over them. And on the other, it produced a false dependence among Indians by increasing their desire for goods and consumption. So, just to recapitulate, you know, Gandhi thinks, he responds to the arguments of his interlocutor in Swaraj by saying, actually, you know, what if the British were not an invading force? Maybe, you know, we've kept them here out of desire. They came here to trade. We desire their goods. Our subordination makes us even more obsessive about consuming, eternal consumption, and the dependence that that brings forth. And so when we want to repel the British, we can only do so by addressing our desire first, our desire for this father, which makes him, as it were, a false father. We shall see later how Gandhi preferred what he saw as a father's true authority and the corresponding dependence of his son to this false image of patriarchy, in which it is the child who creates the father out of a desire for luxury. Going beyond the world of commodities, the Mahatma argued that religious communities in India also quarreled because they had lost power over and therefore responsibility for their shared society. And he says, the fact is that we have become enslaved and therefore quarrel and like to have our quarrels decided by a third party. Close quote. The children here have set up a father whose interventions in their mutual quarrels will absolve them of the responsibility to become adults. But did Gandhi really want sons to become fathers? A few pages after the editor in Hind Swaraj describes his father as a thief, the reader justifies terrorism by comparing Indians to a child who must be prevented by an act of violence from running into imperialism's fire. So this is another great metaphorical statement. Imperialism is a kind of fire. The child is the heedless Indian nation which is rushing into the fire. And the act of terror is meant to shock the child away from this fire, to actually forcibly rescue the child from immolating itself. Right? What if, suggests the editor, this character in the text, the child is too big and strong to restrain? Would the paternal terrorist cast himself into the flames to demonstrate its danger? By taking these crucial yet apparently unimportant rhetorical devices at face value, Gandhi is able to reverse their logic and leave violence without a subjective place to call its own. And this is to say nothing about the way in which he rethinks the father's authority as well as the son's duty by making the former depend upon the latter's pity and forbearance. So, you know, on the one hand you have the father as a thief and the son who pities the father who's coming as a thief and pretends to be asleep. On the other hand, you have this very powerful child who can swat the father away, you know, basically. It reverses all the relations, right? In the following passage, for example, Gandhi moves from describing the violence of an armed father, the father is thief, to that of a powerful son, the child, the strong child, predicating the parent's authority to his fear and helplessness in the process. And here's the quotation. What do you really do to the child? Supposing that it can exert so much physical force that it renders you powerless and rushes into fire, then you cannot prevent it. There are only two remedies open to you. Either you must kill it in order to prevent it from perishing in the flames, or you must give your own life, because you do not wish to see it perish before your very eyes. You will not kill it. If your heart is not quite full of pity, it is possible that you will not surrender yourself by preceding the child and going into the fire yourself. You therefore helplessly allow it to go into the flames. So again, this way of turning what appears to be a quite everyday and banal illustration, an illustrative argument about the child going into the fire, and completely, if not rendering it absurd, completely changing its meaning, where the, as it were, the onus falls upon the savior, the figure of the putative savior, the terrorist. Right? Are you willing to kill yourself in the process to save this child? If not, then he suggests that the argument falls to the ground, the argument of wanting, of being motivated entirely by the saving of the child. The second moment in Ronell's argument has to do with her attempt to think about authority as a form that is crucial to politics and yet, like Gandhi's violence, without a place of its own. For if authority is distinct from compulsion, if authority is not simply, I can force you to do something, it's something actually in addition to that. If authority is distinct from compulsion, then its visibility becomes the same thing as its absence. So when you're actually forced to exert authority, you lose it. Authority only remains authority if it doesn't need to apply force. So can authority ever exist? Or does it need to be spoken about only in the past tense? As Ronell shows us the philosophers Hannah Arendt and Alexandre Kojève do. The everyday relations of fathers and sons allow Ronell to think about the problem of an invisible authority, one that can only be betrayed by its manifestation as force. She is concerned with the way in which compulsion becomes a sign of failure, with authority forever looming over its subjects and goading them to more self-destructive violence. Gandhi also thought violence was a mark of failure, and saw nonviolence, precisely because it was a negative concept derived from its all-too-real opposite, as the only form that authority could take. So it's interesting, right? He says on many occasions, look, nonviolence does not exist, literally. Both in Sanskrit, ahimsa, where it's a negation, and it is dependent entirely on its opposite, violence, himsa. But I'm suggesting it's precisely this, as it were, curious non-visibility or non-existence of non-violence that makes it into something authoritative. Indeed, he argued that it was this non-entity, one that possessed no history precisely because it was invisible in its ubiquity, which made quotidian existence possible. And this not because it put a stop to violence, which Gandhi thought an inevitable part of living, but by converting it into its opposite, as we have seen the editor in Hind Swaraj do, when he deals with these metaphors. Ronell's book is full of defeated fathers who, like the ghost of Hamlet's father, return as apparitions, demanding a vengeance that will destroy their sons in the retrospective process of fulfilling the desire for patriarchy. So you know the story of Hamlet in Shakespeare, right? The father has been killed. He returns in a dream to his son Hamlet, who then takes up the mission to avenge his father and kill his uncle, right? And prove his mother to have betrayed his father. So it's again, it's a family romance. It's a family, but romance is not the right word, but it's a family story in which it is the inability or the failure of the father that is the moving force. And Hamlet, in destroying himself to demonstrate the father's authority, actually does quite the opposite. It is also populated, that is to say, Ronell's text is also populated by sons whose childhood cannot be confined to any age, but returns in an equally spectral fashion to haunt them as a status that can never be overcome. So like Hamlet, we take him to be an adult in the beginning, but quickly it becomes evident that he is in fact a child, right? Or in some aspects of his character, he's a child. You can never actually move away from these statuses. In this situation, neither accepting the father and, like Hamlet, dying in the process, nor rejecting and so replacing him in the classically Freudian manner will bring about any kind of emancipation, personal or political. The implication being that politics is not only deprived of autonomy, but even as a phenomenon out of place, can no longer rely upon a logic or trajectory for which dialectical relationships between fathers, sons, and other identifiable subjects are required. That there is no easy transition from son to father, or indeed from father to son. If the father-son relationship has to be construed after the fact, it cannot be the cause of anything, but only an effect of the search for an authority that is nowhere to be found. But what happens if there is no presumption of such a relationship to begin with? I'd like to offer an example of this situation by looking at the way in which Gandhi thought about paternity in the context of colonialism, which arguably served as one of the earliest political forms relying upon the displacement of fathers and sons as categories of identification, where you can easily identify someone as being a father and someone a son. The Mahatma's autobiography, first published in 1927, begins with a surfeit of fathers from the alien rulers, whose representatives are called Ma-Bap, mother-father, to the petty Indian ruler called Bapa, father in Gujarati, whom Gandhi's own father served as prime minister. While ostensibly augmenting each other's authority, these fathers existed in a relationship of mutual denial and emasculation, putting the category itself into question by its very multiplicity. For Gandhi tells us, quote, "My father was a Divan, prime minister, but nevertheless a servant, and all the more so because he was in favor with the Thakur Sahib, the ruler." The young Gandhi is described in the autobiography as a stereotype, puny, cowardly, and attached to his mother. He tries to match up to the size and strength of the British by secretly eating goat meat at the behest of a Muslim friend, himself representing another version of masculinity and the history of foreign rule. Named Mohandas, or slave of the child god Krishna, the future Mahatma bore no apparent resemblance to this playful deity known for his tricks and thefts. But Krishna, too, both lacked a father and had too many, since he had been smuggled out of the reach of his uncle, a king who murdered his sister's sons to forestall a prophecy that he would be killed by one, and was brought up away from his parents by a family of pastoralists. Of course, Krishna eventually killed his uncle, though he never became a father in turn, but rather a lover, warrior, and always the trickster. Gandhi, who became an overbearing father, and indeed the father of the nation, being called Bapu, an affectionate form of father by millions, would achieve fearlessness by holding to a non-violence that saw in the sacrifice of one's own life the highest form of courage. He too admired the warrior's duty, but preferred to die rather than kill in demonstrating it. Gandhi did not remain an eternal child, a son like Krishna with too many fathers and so none, but instead became a father for too many and the son of nobody. Two anecdotes about his own father in Gandhi's autobiography tell us how this might have happened. In the first, the son, too afraid to approach his father in person, writes a letter confessing to shaving off some gold from his brother's armlet to pay off the latter's debts. He watches his father read the letter, and instead of punishing the boy, something the latter both desired and feared, proceed to weep silently. And this is, it's a famous passage in the autobiography. "I was trembling as I handed the confession to my father. He was then suffering from a fistula and was confined to bed. His bed was a plain wooden plank. I handed the note and sat opposite the plank. He read it through and pearl drops trickled down his cheeks, wetting the paper. For a moment he closed his eyes in thought and then tore up the note. He had sat up to read it. He again lay down. I also cried. I could see my father's agony. If I were a painter, I could draw a picture of the whole scene today. It is still so vivid in my mind. Those pearl drops of love cleansed my heart and washed my sin away. Only he who has experienced such love can know what it is." Close quote. There is certainly a process of identification here, and we might even see in this incident a precedent for the future Mahatma's own displays of suffering in fasts that broke the resolve of enemies, but not a dialectical relationship. Indeed, if anything, the father is behaving maternally by taking on the role of Gandhi's own mother in forsaking the punishing role his son desired from him, if only to further exacerbate his guilt. Neither castration nor parricide in the psychoanalytic sense is possible here. So it's clear from Gandhi's description of his mother that, you know, these are attitudes or maneuvers that his mother was used to doing. She would fast in protest at something. she would never be violent. And Gandhi apparently learned these attitudes from her. But here it's his father who is, as it were, I'm arguing, taking on the role of the mother and denying Gandhi the punishment that he actually desired and feared. The second incident from the autobiography involves Gandhi as a married man sitting at his father's deathbed. So from the wooden plank that is his sick bed, we move to the deathbed. Feeling the desire for intimate relations with his wife, he leaves his uncle in charge and goes to her. As Gandhi is engaged in intercourse, his father dies in a final inducement of guilt. So Gandhi's father seems to be this, whether deliberately or not, is rather unpleasant person who's constantly inducing guilt in his son. And this is Gandhi. I felt deeply ashamed and miserable. I ran to my father's room. I saw that if animal passion had not blinded me, I should have been spared the torture of separation from my father during his last moments. I should have been massaging him, and he would have died in my arms. But now it was my uncle who had this privilege. Before I close this chapter of my double shame, I may mention that the poor mite that was born to my wife scarcely breathed for more than 3 or 4 days. Nothing else could be expected. Let all those who are married be warned by my example. So not only does the father die, but the child produced, Gandhi's child, the first child dies. Right? And he tells us that nothing else could be expected because of his sin. It is from this period that Gandhi decides to adopt celibacy, though he won't actually do so for some time. Surely this is a typical Freudian situation. The son who kills his father by identifying with him in the sexual act and who is therefore replaced by his uncle while losing his own child in the process. His guilt, in fact, is so great that it determines him upon renouncing intercourse. Celibacy or the retention of sperm, however, was traditionally seen as a sign of masculine power, as indeed by Gandhi himself and his characteristic of ascetics, who are often called Baba or Father. Shiva, for instance, is portrayed as a forest-dwelling ascetic, but also worshipped in the form of a lingam, being in addition a father. So that there is no, there are no Freudian alternatives here. One father cancels out the other, while the son can replace the father in reproduction and remain celibate at the same time, thus taking on both roles, just as Gandhi's father had adopted that of his mother. So it is no accident that Gandhi will also come to identify as a mother, and indeed get his grandniece Manu to call him mother after his wife Kasturba's death, saying, "I have been a father to many, but only to you I am a mother." Close quote. And Manu Gandhi then writes this little booklet called Gandhi, My Mother. It is as if he wanted in this way to bring his wife back to life in his own person. It's kind of strange, what seems strange to us today, this ability of Gandhi to occupy multiple subject positions and therefore make the relations between any two subjects too plural to actually subsist. I would like to suggest that it is the excessive and even stereotypical meaningfulness of the Mahatma's autobiography in psychoanalytic terms which leads to its loss of meaning altogether. So all the things I was saying, you know, the kind of putatively Freudian instances of the father and the sex and etc., they seem to make sense initially, and then when we look further, they seem to disintegrate in the process. For the multiplicity of fathers and sons in the narrative, some of who occupy more than one role, renders identification either as acceptance or rejection impossible. Gandhi seems to revel in adopting all kinds of familial roles and sticking to none. His treatment of his own sons being particularly oppressive because of his ability to colonize the place of authority as much as dissent. For his unorthodox experiments in domestic life were twinned with those in anti-colonial resistance to make for a potent mix of the personal and the political. Having refused to advance them in life out of a sense of impartiality, the Mahatma was faced with the rebellion of one of his sons, Harilal, who eventually died a drunken vagrant, his wife and children having been taken in by Gandhi in an apparently classic instance of the father castrating his son. So there are these sort of apparently classical moments in psychoanalytic terms in Gandhi's autobiography, but my argument is that they actually suggest a very different kind of argument. Gandhi's own son then was unable either to defeat or replace him. Remember, this is Avital Ronell's thesis, right? The son reinforces the authority or the power of the father, whether he resists him or accepts him. Gandhi's own son then was unable either to defeat or replace him, this feat being accomplished by his assassin, a militant who finally made a patriarch out of the Mahatma. For Nathuram Godse tells us in his lengthy courtroom address that he killed the Mahatma out of respect for him, in order to prevent the old man from expending his love on Muslims, who, like treacherous and changeling sons, would only betray him once again, as they had already betrayed and in fact divided Mother India. So you see the almost excessive use of these familial metaphors, right, in the political language of the day. And here is Nathuram Godse in his trial. Gandhiji is being referred to as the father of the nation, an epithet of high reverence. But if so, he has failed in his paternal duty, inasmuch as he has acted very treacherously to the nation by his consenting to the partitioning of it. Had Gandhiji really maintained his opposition to the creation of Pakistan, the Muslim League could have had no strength to claim it, and the Britishers also could not have created it in spite of all their utmost efforts for its establishment. The reason for this is not far to seek. The people of this country were eager and vehement in their opposition to Pakistan, but Gandhi played false with the people and gave parts of the country to the Muslims for the creation of Pakistan. I stoutly maintain that Gandhiji, in doing so, has failed in his duty, which was incumbent upon him to carry out as the father of the nation. He has proved to be the father of Pakistan. It was for this reason alone that I, as a dutiful son of Mother India, thought it my duty to put an end to the life of the so-called father of the nation, who had played a very prominent part in bringing about the vivisection of the country, our motherland. So again, excessive, psychoanalytically excessive. The son of the mother who has to kill the father who has betrayed the mother and who has become the father of another, right? And yet at the same time, notice the importance he gives to Gandhi. Only Gandhi could have prevented this. Only the father could have prevented this. The true son must therefore avenge the father by killing him and taking his place, with Godse maintaining that, quote, "I shall bow in respect of the service done by Gandhiji to the country, and to Gandhiji himself for the said service, and before I fire the shots, I actually wished him and bowed to him in reverence," close quote. So here is the son who has killed the father, but who bows to Gandhi and honors him before he kills him. Godse, it seems, was so taken up with the fantasy of a national fatherhood that he neglected to note how Gandhi had in fact consistently repudiated any single model of human relationship for the nation. Indeed, in line with Hindu tradition, he thought that one's dharma or duty was not generic but had to be determined by context, or rather by who one was. Remember in that quotation I read out from Hind Swaraj, where Gandhi says, if you're a weak man, who is the thief who comes to you? Your duty, he doesn't use that word there, but your dharma would depend entirely upon who that was. It's entirely context-specific, right? Thus, if the relations between Hindus and Muslims, whom the Mahatma considered to be political equals, was to be defined by mitrata, or friendship, as well as a brotherhood, the unequal relations between higher and lower castes should be defined by seva, or service. This is what, you know, there's no single set of relations. So when during the Round Table Conference of 1931, Gandhi was asked by a representative of the Muslim League to look upon the Prophet's followers as his children, the Mahatma shocked the Aga Khan by refusing to do so. And it was only many years later that he explained why. He says, I didn't mean that I was aware of no emotional attachment, no feeling for the welfare of Muslims. I only meant that I was conscious of full brotherhood, yes, but not the superiority that fatherhood would imply. Close quote. The nation-state, we might say, requires the Mahatma to become its father, and in this way reinstates the logic of patriarchy in politics, despite Gandhi's own intentions and eccentricities. And so the loser son, and loser son, by the way, loser sons is the title of Avital Ronell's book, right? And so the loser son, who Gandhi undoubtedly was, ends up becoming the father of his country, for those who revere as well as revile him. But the unfatherly elements of his career continue to roil Indian society, for which non-dialectical relations and the avoidance of identification remain important. No one is ever simply a father or a son. Ronell writes that in the Western tradition, neither the child nor the slave has ever represented the ideal of freedom in politics. Yet it is precisely slaves and children whom the Mahatma himself, remember that slave of a child god, holds up as such ideals in his commentary on the famous Sanskrit text, the Sanskrit text. The Bhagavad Gita, or Song of the Lord, recounts a conversation between the warrior Arjuna and his divine charioteer Krishna, the two being situated between opposing armies drawn up on a battlefield and awaiting only the command to fight what will be an apocalyptic war. Now let me pause here and note that, you know, just as I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, here you have a situation of, as for fratricide, that is being described in among modern Indian commentators of the Gita as a fratricidal situation. It's not a patriarchal situation. It's very interesting. One father is dead, the other is blind, who has to Dhritarashtra, who is watching through an intermediary, through Sanjaya, right? And when you look at the commentaries on the Gita by people like Tilak or Aurobindo or Bankim, or there are many, it's clear that though the Gita has become a way to think about Indian modern Indian politics in its anti-colonial form, fatherhood seems not to be a great issue. Right? One of the reasons, I think, why the Gita becomes important is it's the problem and the promise of fratricide that is crucial in it. That is to say, violence between Indians themselves, of all kinds, you know, in caste terms, in regional terms, in linguistic terms, in religious terms, in many different in terms of those who are loyal to the British and those who are not. This becomes, even before the going of the Raj, this becomes the great problem. Right? How do you actually constitute a community of brothers? What does fratricide mean? And I think it's very interesting because it seems to show the ability of these Indian thinkers and statesmen to actually imagine a politics beyond the colonial state. It's not the patriarchal relation that's important here. Now, surveying the friends, relatives, and preceptors in the ranks of his enemies, Arjuna suddenly loses the will to fight, and Krishna's task is to persuade him to do so. One of the lessons Gandhi takes from this conversation is that choice can never be the basis of morality, since it has been rendered superfluous. For a war will occur on the Gita's battlefield, whatever Arjuna decides. As an instrumental act, moreover, choice sacrifices the present for an imagined future, thus sapping the former of all reality in an extraordinarily violent way. And the Mahatma even goes so far as to describe it as a kind of illness. So basically he's saying, look, in everyday, in the kind of commonplace or even indeed philosophical dispositions on what it is to be moral, choice is often given us as the prime subject, right? You must choose between one thing and the other. And Gandhi here is suggesting, well, choice isn't always possible. On the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Arjuna in a way has no choice. Because if he wants to save lives, his going or his staying will not make a difference. It might, of course, make one army win and the other lose. But that is not the issue. That's not the issue that faces him. He's troubled because he doesn't want to kill his friends and his relations and his preceptor in the army of the Kauravas. So Gandhi actually poses the question like this. What is it possible to have morality in a situation without choice, or where choice has been rendered irrelevant? And then he goes on to suggest that actually choice, because it tends to be instrumental, it is made in the context of some future good, sacrifices the present and is in itself not moral. That morality should be entirely located in the present. You can't make the people of the present into mere means for some future good. And therefore, he says things like the following, where he tries to push aside choice, the essence of morality, and thinks not only about duty, about dharma, right? Famously, as you all know, I need not tell you in the Gita, that one should perform desireless action. Right? That dharma is what you perform your acts out of duty, out of principle, if you will, without regard for the fruits of those actions. But here is Gandhi talking about, as it were, action without choice. When a man's ears, nose, eyes, and so on go on performing their functions naturally without conscious willing on his part, the winking of the eyelids does not need to be willed. There must be some disease if it were otherwise. We say of such a person that his sense organs, having become free of attachments and aversions, function spontaneously. So here he says, what does it mean spontaneously, right? Not an act of will. Once you train yourself to respond or to act spontaneously, naturally, without willing, without choice in that sense, then you're acting morally and in the present. Right? You literally forget what the object might be. In any case, says Gandhi, knowledge is never sufficient for any moral choice, even though the latter depends absolutely upon it. The absence of such knowledge further inevitably disqualifies all but an intellectual or political elite from exercising it with any justice. Right? So when we talk about choice, choice is always informed choice, therefore there are good choices and there are bad choices, therefore it presupposes a moral hierarchy, since some people are more qualified to make good choices than other people. So if you are a highly educated, literate man, your choice is morally more correct than that of an illiterate, poor woman, for instance. So for these reasons, Gandhi sees choice as being actually, to use our language, undemocratic. Right? That it's the wrong kind of morality. For all these reasons, then, the Mahatma rejects freedom of choice as a degrading sign of hierarchy. One should do one's duty out of principle alone and without taking any notice of causes or consequences, with Gandhi often saying that he did not need to know what happened in order to act morally when faced with violence. He doesn't need to know who started it, what it, you know, that story that we always tell at a moment of violence. And though he was at other times an advocate of conscience, which he called the inner voice, Gandhi also repudiates it here as a form of narcissistic disembodiment. Instead of choice, free will, and conscience, then, he recommends sacrifice as the only kind of moral act that is truly universal and available to everyone. Gandhi conceived of sacrifice as a form of abstention, such as fasting, celibacy, non-cooperation, or non-violent resistance to the death, all of which transformed an immoral situation by the negative act of withdrawal, rather than by proposing a positive alternative that could only take its place, as the rebel son would that of his father. And I'm quoting, this is from Gandhi's 1926 commentary on the Gita, which was made over several days at Sabarmati Ashram in Ahmedabad. All this talk about knowledge is because of the body. Otherwise, for an unembodied one, how can there be any question of knowledge? The highest knowledge of all in the world is knowledge of the self. Moreover, the idea of a human being having no body exists only in our imagination. Mortification of the body, therefore, is the only means of self-realization and the only yajna, the only sacrifice for everyone in the world. So again, this is another way of trying to circumvent what he sees as the hierarchical nature of choice and conscience, right? Conscience as a disembodied voice, and choice as this kind of, that imposes a moral hierarchy. He disavows here and talks about bodily mortification, sacrifice in physical terms almost, as the only yajna that is actually available to everyone without distinction. It is in this context that Gandhi makes the most disadvantage of figures, children and slaves, into models of moral life. Since no ethics would be worth its salt if it deprived society's weakest members of such a life. So again, extraordinary, in a world where, in a history where it has generally been the adult male, the adult free male, who has been the ideal of moral life, Gandhi opts for the child and the slave. But the slave and the child were models for another reason also. because they alone could live fully in the present, relieved by their parents and masters of the kind of abstract and violent instrumentality that was determined by a future. So just as moral choice, as I suggest, is linked to a future good and therefore instrumentalizes its means in an undharmic, adharmic way, here the child and the slave live, in his words, fully in the present. They have been deprived of their future in some way because of the authority of the parent, the father, or the master. So they can fully attend to the present, and the gravity of the present is fully available to them and apparent to them. Which, of course, we tend to see as being illusory, right? How can you be so attentive to a leaf, for instance, right? If you're a child playing in the garden, and not be attentive to the fact that you would be hungry in 2 hours for your lunch. But for Gandhi, this is exactly the moral attitude, right? To be fully focused on where you are at the moment you are in. While disapproving of the master's paternal figure, therefore, the Mahatma praised the slave and his close cousin, the child, because by living in the present, they not only treated it with requisite moral seriousness, but by their refusal to think in terms of the future, at the same time, made room for the incalculable, something that spoke of the insufficiency of knowledge and that was capable of transforming history more effectively than the best laid plans ever could. And, you know, Gandhi would often say, with regards to political life, look, you know, we tend to plan for the future, politicians all do that. But even if they achieve their desires, the unintended consequences of this future is something they can never predict. In any case, political plans generally don't succeed. And in their not succeeding, they are as violent as when they do succeed. Because there's an element of the incalculable about life. That the instrumentality of politics tries to avoid, but in fact cannot. So here is describing the child as a moral agent. The child, remember, is an utterly dependent creature. Right? Exactly the exact opposite of the traditional figure of the moral, the free male moral figure. So if children have faith, they can live as a sthitapragna, as one who is single-minded or self-possessed does. They have their parents and teachers to look after their needs. They have, therefore, no need to take thought for themselves. They should always be guided by their elders. A child who lives in this manner is a brahmachari, a celibate or unattached person, a muni, a saint, if you will, a sthitapragna. He is so in the sense that he does what he is asked to and carries out every instruction. Close quote. So this might seem to be exactly the opposite of a moral agent, right? Someone who obeys orders. Is this the voice of a father or a son? By focusing exclusively on the present, Gandhi manages to avoid the various logics, dialectics, and trajectories that require the future for their existence, all of which are crucial for any conception of politics. And in doing so, he also circumvents the generational narrative of paternal or filial identification. But where does his authority come from? Could it be the radicalization of obedience as an act that is not only inevitable, even in the world of conscience where we have to obey our better selves, but one that can also manifest itself as the epitome of choice? So this passage just read out to you. You know, the child obeys authority like the slave and therefore is free. You might think, well, how odd. I'm suggesting here that Gandhi also realizes that obedience, just like the familiar language that I say is inevitable in politics, the idea of obedience too, of course, is inevitable in some way, whether you choose your own obedience. Even as I suggest, if you obey your own inner self. So even if it is yourself who you're obeying, it's something intractable, you can't get away from it. And he's trying to, as well, moralize it here. For the Mahatma, it's clear that choice is devalued into self-gratification the more it is exercised, which means that it's self-abnegation in a single act of obedience to a moral duty, seen as something forever external and non-subjective, turns out to be its moment of apotheosis. So, let me read you this passage from Gandhi, and then we can talk about what this might mean. The action of a man whose intellect is not fixed on one aim, who is not single-minded in his devotion, will branch out in many directions. As the mind leaps monkey-fashion from branch to branch, so does the intellect. A person who clings to his life will seek help from any vaid or saint or witch doctor whom he meets. Similarly, a monkey will fly from branch to branch and ultimately meet an untimely death, the victim of a slingshot. The mind of a person of uncertain purpose grows weak day by day and becomes so unsettled that he can think of nothing except what is in his mind at the moment. Right? An interesting, somewhat funny thing, the slingshot killing the monkey. But what's interesting about it is that he's suggesting the choice, the more you exercise, you know, choice, you choose this, you choose that, the variety of choice actually cancels it out. It just becomes, as he says it, the person of uncertain purpose grows weak by week, day by day, and becomes so unsettled that he can think of nothing else except what is in his mind at the moment. That the extreme of choice is actually its abandonment. So obedience to some external authority, whether one you have set up yourself, or someone who compels obedience not by violence but morally, is crucial even for choice. That choice exercised once, the choice to obey, is a more powerful form of choice, of freedom, than the repeated exercise of choice in this degrading way that he describes. The paradox of obedience as the most precious form of choice lies in its repudiation of subjection. By maintaining the externality of its self-selected and quite particular form of authority, which for the Gandhi was the Gita, though it might be any other text or person, obedience in this way attempts to exit the play of identification altogether. The Mahatma's most famous accounts of such obedience to a duty imposed from the outside all involve the sacrifice of relatives, especially parents and children. So if Arjuna's dilemma has to do with his desire to avoid killing his relations, among Gandhi's other heroes, Harishchandra is happy to slay his wife and son, not happy, but is willing to slay his wife and son, while Prahlad, in effect, becomes a parasite by praying that Vishnu deliver him from his father's tyranny. And these are the set of figures whom Gandhi refers to over and over again, these sacrificial figures. Prahlad, Harishchandra, Arjuna. Rama as well, of course, as the hero of sacrifice, who is willing to sacrifice his wife and children. Unlike the Abrahamic story that sets a model for sacrifice in the monotheistic religions, including the crucifixion of Jesus and the martyrdom of Hussein, it is not only the sacrifice of a son that is important here, but that of the father as well. In yet another example of the way in which identifying with one or the other is evaded. Indeed, even when Gandhi did invoke such biblical themes, he often reversed their narrative logic, as when he famously described the partition of India in Solomonic terms, but as the vivisection of a mother by her sons, rather than the reverse. You know, it's the story of King Solomon, who has a child whom two mothers are claiming, and he says, well, I'll cut it in half. And the real mother, of course, says, no, I'll give up my claim, etc. So Gandhi uses this term and he changes it around in the mother who is being divided by her sons. By refusing to distinguish between the sacrifice of oneself and one's kinsfolk, or rather that of one generation for another, the Mahatma short-circuits the dialectical relationship between past, present, and future that makes of politics the kind of instrumentalism it is. In the eternal present for moral life, whose paragons are children and slaves, sacrifice is available to everyone and does not have to be for anything. Or rather, a childlike attention to the present, in which alone could moral life occur, allowed Gandhi to keep the future open by attending to the incalculable within it. Instead of trying to predetermine this future in the way that politics routinely did, either negatively as a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, or positively with its success blighted by unintended consequences, attending to the incalculable meant adopting a religious attitude towards it. For the incalculable was neither more nor less than the incarnation of God on earth, something that broke through the causality of human action, intention, or generation to transform it utterly. Thank you.